From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jay McInerney's best-selling novel, Bright Lights, Big City, chronicled the New York club scene of the early 80s. His new book examines the scene at the end of the decade. On today's Fresh Air, McInerney reads from both novels and compares those stories to his own life. Also today, John Beard tells us how to crucify actors. Beard was production designer for The Last Temptation of Christ and the Monty Python biblical spoof, The Life of Brian. And we have reviews of USA Today's new television show and of the new album from the West Coast jazz band Rebirth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Bright Lights, Big City is considered the first novel to chronicle the New York downtown club scene of the 80s. It's about a young writer from the suburbs making his way in the city. He loses his job and his bearings after too many nights spent partying until morning, sniffing too much cocaine. Bright Lights, Big City inaugurated the Vintage Contemporaries paperback series, became a bestseller, and was adapted into a film starring Michael J. Fox. A novelist, Jay McInerney, became one of the most talked-about young writers of the 80s. McInerney's second novel, Ransom, was set in Japan, but he returned to New York nightlife for his new novel, Story of My Life. It's narrated by a 20-year-old would-be actress. She frequently misses her acting classes because she's been out partying late or up all night having sex with a new boyfriend. She and her friends live on their parents' checks and credit cards. Many of McInerney's readers expected him to get out of the club scene for his new novel, but McInerney thinks the setting of his new novel, Story of My Life, is actually very different from that of Bright Lights, Big City.
Well, I think of it as a somewhat different scene. Bright Lights, Big City is really about the beginning of the 80s and is set in the beginning of the 80s. And this is a bookend to that book, Bright Lights, Big City. It's a darker and a scarier book, I think, although, again, I hope it's funny. But this scene, insofar as this is somewhat a book about the nightclub scene, this is an unusual kind of milieu and a kind of meetings spot, almost a melting pot, if you will. And New York is an interesting city in that people from a lot of different worlds tend to come together here in a way that they really don't in places like Washington and Los Angeles, where you essentially have company towns. And for better or worse, this idea of the nightclub, of there being a place that everybody wants to, that everybody feels is the center of the world, still has a pretty powerful grip here in New York, and it's a place where a lot of different people converge and intersect.
How is that scene different now than it was when you first wrote Bright Lights, Big City? Do you think the scene has changed a lot?
Well, yeah, there's a kind of real fin de siècle feel now. I mean, it is very self-conscious and somewhat exhausted, if you will. And yet, as I say, I think it maintains its grip. When I was, the period I was writing about in Bright Lights, Big City, which was really 1981, 1982 was the actual setting of that book, there was a kind of underground club scene at that time, particularly centered around the East Village. There were these places like the Mud Club, which were considered kind of salons for the avant-garde. They were not written about in New York Magazine. They certainly were not written about in Time Magazine. These were places that you had to know about, and it was a sort of a mark of hipness to know about them. There were places where musicians and artists, and yes, even writers would come together to try out their new haircuts and maybe even talk about their work, or that at least was the idea. And it was a very powerful myth. I mean, we wanted it to be like Paris in the 20s, I suppose, and to some extent, yeah, perhaps it was. I mean, there were people like the people who became known as the East Village artists, you know, Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat and Kenny Scharf were part of that scene. Musicians like Deborah Harry and David Byrne were the kind of people you were apt to run into as well. Now in the late 80s, I think, in a sense, everyone is trying to trying to relive what might be perceived almost as a kind of golden era of that nightlife, and it's a lot more self-conscious. The places come and go even more quickly now, as everybody wants to be at the newest one. The whole idea of the new is something that keeps accelerating. And at the same time, it's not as much of an avant-garde scene. It is something that's covered so heavily by the media and watched so closely that you do have sort of hip stockbrokers sort of rubbing shoulders with Cher and, and this sort of performance artist and lowlife element is almost crowded out of the scene.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to read the opening from your new novel, Story of My Life. And the novel is written in the voice of the main character, Alison Pool.
Yeah, I should explain. I'm not going to read this in a soprano, but you'll just have to suspend your belief a little more than usual, perhaps. This is just from the beginning, a chapter called Getting in Touch with Your Child. I'm like, I don't believe this. I'm totally pissed at my old man who's somewhere in the Virgin Islands. I don't know where. The check wasn't in the mailbox today, which means I can't go to school Monday morning. I'm on the monthly payment program, because Dad says wanting to be an actress is some flaky whim, and I never stick to anything. This from a guy who's been married 5 times. And this way, if I drop out in the middle of the semester, he won't get burned for the full tuition. Meanwhile, he buys his new bimbo, Tanya, who's a year younger than me, a 450 SL convertible. Always gone for the young ones, haven't we, Dad? Plus her own condo, so she can have some privacy to do her writing. Like she can even read. He actually believes her when she says she's writing a novel. But when I want to spend 8 hours a day busting ass at Lee Strasberg, it's like another one of Allison's crazy ideas. Story of my life. My old man's 52, going on 12. And then there's Skip Pendleton, which is another reason I'm pissed. So I'm on the phone screaming at my father's secretary when there's a call on my other line. I go, hello, and this guy goes, hi, I'm whatever his name is. I'm a friend of Skip's. And I say, yeah? And he says, I thought maybe we could go out sometime. And I say, what am I, dial-a-date? Skip Pendleton's this jerk I was in lust with once for about 3 minutes. He hasn't called me in like 3 weeks, which is fine, okay, I can deal with that. But suddenly I'm like a baseball card he trades with his friends. Give me a break. So I go to this guy, what makes you think I'd want to go out with you? I don't even know you. And he says, Skip told me about you. Right. So I'm like, what did he tell you? And the guy goes, Skip said you were hot. I say, great. I am totally honored that the great Skip Pendleton thinks I'm hot. I'm just a jalapeno pepper waiting for some strange burrito, honey. I mean, really.
Well, this character's voice is obviously really clearly stated in your head. What made that voice so appealing, so interesting to you, that you wanted to write a novel in that voice?
Well, it's a voice that I hear all around me, and I have for a long time. I just didn't realize it until about a year ago when I overheard a conversation taking place entirely in this dialect, what I think of as a sort of dialect of the American language. And it's really all around us. I hadn't really seen it in a book before, but I hear it everywhere. I hear it on the streets. I even hear it on television. It has some curious features. It's almost entirely present tense, this particular dialect. And the speech verbs are all more like action verbs. You say, I go, you want to dance. And he goes, yeah, sure. As opposed to I said, she said, he said. Another one is, I'm like, what's your name? And he's like, my name's Dean. In some ways, I think a very limited language. And then again, I think it's very, to me, it just has a certain music, a certain kind of rhythm. I think all idiomatic speech is potentially interesting. I mean, and the tradition of the idiomatic novel certainly goes back at least as far as Mark Twain in our literature. Huck Finn is not the most articulate guy in the world, and yet I find that language to be very beautiful. And in a sense, the limitations of this dialect kind of give the reader room to move around and sort of know more than the narrator knows.
This is a woman, this main character, who's on the whole pretty superficial and who has a really unusual sex life. She likes plenty of sex, but she doesn't necessarily take precautions against sexually transmitted diseases. But her big fear is that sperm has a lot of calories, so she has to be careful about oral sex. because she was once slightly anorexic. What interests you in this character? I mean, it's obviously a pretty superficial character, but enough interesting in it to write a whole novel.
Well, I would take issue with that entirely.
Okay.
I don't think she's any more superficial than any 20-year-old girl
or
guy. I think she's very smart, and it's easy to confuse education with intelligence. In fact, Allison has not had a chance to get a Radcliffe education, partly because her parents just haven't really given her that kind of upbringing, although they've given her everything else. They've given her a lot of credit cards. They've given her horses and cars and so on. But I find her to be a very intelligent person underneath this veneer of kind of glib superficiality, and that was one of my challenges, was to try and give depth and likability to a character who at first seems a little shallow and maybe not so likable, a little bit like a spoiled brat. But in fact, I mean, Allison is keeping fast company, and she is a very acute observer of for instance, the guys that she goes out with tend to be, 30, 35-year-old world beaters, bond traders and guys who own their own commodities companies. And I think Allison tends to be smarter than most of them. As much as she lives a kind of life which is faster, wilder, and crazier than, say, her average counterpart in maybe Ann Arbor, Michigan, I don't think that she's so radically different than that Midwestern girl, say. And sometimes I think you have to look at the extremes of a society in order to illuminate the middle. I also think her sex life is less unusual than you might than you just indicated you felt it was. I think we read a lot of feature articles about how sexual behavior in this country has changed. I don't see that to be the case myself.
That's interesting. My guest is Jay McInerney, and his new novel is called Story of My Life. He's also the author of Bright Lights, Big City and Ransom. Bright Lights, Big City is about a writer who's thrown off balance by the club scene and finally bottoms out. When you first got to New York, did you start gravitating to the clubs right away?
Well, I was actually living in Japan, and I started hearing about...
you were on a scholarship in Japan.
Oh, yeah, I was on a fellowship from Princeton University studying Japanese. I was also on my own studying martial arts. And I just started hearing about this art and music scene in the East Village, which interested me a lot. It had been... When I left the States for Japan in 1976, 77... It just seemed to me there was nothing happening culturally, politically, that things were kind of dead. And gradually news started drifting toward Tokyo about, a kind of little artistic renaissance focused around the East Village in New York that had to do, as I say, with sort of graffiti art, with new wave music. There seemed to be a new vitality in the arts around the late 70s, and New York seemed to be the center of that scene. And I came back for, I suppose, partly with that in mind, and in fact moved to the East Village.
How much did the status within the clubs matter to you, getting admittance to the VIP rooms, for instance?
Well, I never was... I was just a kid, and I didn't even know how to dress for that whole scene. I was really very much an outsider. I was just trying to soak up as much as I could of the whole scene. And I suppose I would have liked to have been an insider, but it was not an option for me at that time. I had to hang out with people who were much cooler than me in order to get to get taken in. And that's certainly, I think, true of the character in Bright Lights, Big City as well. Without Tad Allagash at his side, he wouldn't be getting into these places.
Was there a Tad Allagash character in your life, someone who was not only more into the scene but also a lot more corrupt?
Yeah, there has always been a Tad Allagash in my life, I think, and most of us probably. I like to think that many of us have a Tad Allagash in our life. I've had about 10 of them myself, and there are various claimants to the role of model for Tad Allagash here in New York. Although, actually, I can think of one who's in Tokyo and one who's in Memphis, Tennessee, that are just as likely. But Tad is the guy who always seems to know what he's doing. He seems socially well-adjusted. He's cool. He at least gives the illusion of knowing appearing to know what's going on. And I think most of us in our heart of hearts are insecure. And even if we don't, even if we secretly think someone like Dad is corrupt and superficial, we really sometimes want to be just like that. And so, yeah, I've had people like that in my life, and I've always have felt myself kind of socially maladjusted, and I think that's an essential kind of part of the psychological makeup of being a writer. If you were really happy with the world as it is, then I don't think you'd go to all the trouble of reinventing it for 200 or 300 pages.
Well, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to read the opening of your novel, Bright Lights, Big City. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Jay McInerney, the author of Bright Lights, Big City, Ransom, and a new novel called Story of My Life. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jay McInerney is my guest. Jay, can I ask you to read the beginning, the opening paragraph of your novel, Bright Lights, Big City?
Sure. You're not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning, but here you are, and you cannot say that the terrain is entirely unfamiliar, although the details are fuzzy. You're at a nightclub talking to a girl with a shaved head. The club is either Heartbreak or the Lizard Lounge. All might come clear if you could just slip into the bathroom and do a little more Bolivian marching powder. Then again, it might not. A small voice inside you insists that this epidemic lack of clarity is a result of too much of that already. The night has already turned on that imperceptible pivot where 2 a.m. changes to 6 a.m. You know this moment has come and gone, but you are not yet willing to concede that you have crossed the line beyond which all is gratuitous damage and the palsy of unraveled nerve endings. Somewhere back there you could have cut your losses, but you rode past that moment on a comet trail of white powder, and now you're trying to hang on to the rush. Your brain at this moment is composed of brigades of tiny Bolivian soldiers. They are tired and muddy from their long march through the night. There are holes in their boots, and they are hungry. They need to be fed. They need the Bolivian marching powder.
You know, we talked earlier about writing your new novel in the voice of the main character and writing in the kind of dialect that she speaks. This novel is first person, but written in the second person. It's written in the voice of the character, but it's written in the you instead of the I.
Yeah, second person singular.
Yeah, and it made me wonder if you talk that way to yourself.
I do, I think.
Do you?
Yeah, I think comparing notes with other people, I think most people do somewhat and don't notice it that often. It's only when you really catch yourself saying something out loud that I think you might realize that the second person form of address is a pretty common kind of interior monologue. I don't think we go around saying I to ourselves.
Yeah, it just
I am crossing the street now.
Right.
Now I see the Plaza Hotel. You know, I think it's I think we're much more apt to, insofar as our kind of inner landscape has any grammar and syntax to it. I think that this is a way that people do talk to themselves, at least in English. I'm not sure about like Pushto or Russian, but when I say this, you know, will then sort of catch themselves a day or two later and say, oh yeah, you're right, I do talk to myself in the second person.
When you started writing Bright Lights, Big City, did you think that the voice and the subject was something that was going to be perceived as unique to your generation and that wouldn't translate to, say, older editors who might read the manuscript?
No, I just didn't see the subject matter as being that much of an issue. And I mean, to me, it was a background that I was familiar with, and it seemed I had been told that a writer should write what he knows. It's hard enough to write a novel and to deal with all the variables involved there, and it helps if you, you know, if you're dealing with a landscape that you're somewhat familiar with. But I guess I just didn't. I was just afraid that no one would be particularly interested in this. I mean, forget about my peers. I just thought, you know, maybe me, my editor, and a few of my closest friends. I might read it out of duty. But it didn't seem at the time like any kind of surefire thing. And we were all surprised by this popular response to the book.
Well, in fact, your novel is considered one of the first, or perhaps the first, books in what became almost a genre, in the sense of, you know, first-person, present-tense type books,
well,
with the club scene either as a setting or a backdrop.
I don't know. Well, insofar as that's a genre, it was the first. I don't like to think of this as a genre, in that I think there's been a tendency in the media to sort of lump fairly disparate writers together on the basis of our age and subject matter, which to me are the least interesting things about my work, they tend to emphasize the least interesting aspects of everyone's work when we start getting these sort of trend.
Yeah.
Identifications.
Well, do you almost feel like you've been held responsible for shortcomings in subsequent novels written by other people?
I do, yeah. I feel that I get occasionally thrashed for somebody else's novel as if I were some sort of literary godfather. And I want to say, hey, I didn't write that one, guys.
Your novel, Bright Lights, Big City, was made into a movie that was released earlier this year. And you wrote the first screenplay, the draft of the first screenplay. Then there were several other subsequent drafts written by other people.
About 17, I think.
Which is quite a lot, even for the movie industry. And then you ended up being brought in for the actual making of the movie, after the movie had already gone through one director and a second, James Bridges, was hired. Did you feel satisfied with the final product?
Yeah, and I felt pretty happy with the final product. I mean, the process itself was nightmarish. And if I'd ever known what was involved from the beginning, I think I just would have said, you go off and make it by yourself, guys.
Which is kind of what they wanted to do, probably.
Yeah, well, I wrote three drafts, and then they stopped answering my phone calls for about 2 years. And then I heard it was being filmed in New York. And friends of mine were getting calls to have their lofts rented for locations, and I was feeling very much left out of it. Then that particular director was fired after, 9 or 10 days of shooting, and James Bridges came in and rescued the project and called me up and said that he'd read the 18 or so drafts that there were extant, and he liked my first draft the best, and would I just come in and rewrite it with him so that we could... We were really doing it by the seat of our pants, because he started shooting 3 days after he took over the project. And initially, there was virtually no script. We were really shooting straight out of the book. I think it was a happy experience in that sometimes it's better to do things quickly this project already had dragged on for 3 years. So I think some of the sort of nervous energy that we all had having to shoot this movie in 6.5 weeks was conveyed on the screen in a positive way. And it was fun to be working that directly. Most screenwriters hand in their script and they never hear from anybody again. But I was going down to the set every day and rewriting lines if need be. And I was also a little bit involved in the editing process. In the end, I had a very happy collaboration. The first three quarters of the experience I could have done without.
What was your reaction when you found out that Michael J. Fox was going to play the main character? And I ask that since he had a reputation for being a fairly conventional actor because he was most identified with family ties on TV.
Well, my first reaction was that I didn't get it.
Like how he could fit the character.
Yeah, but then again, I had not, I think I'd only seen one episode of Family Ties. So I may not have had as much of a problem as people have been watching the show for 5 or 6 years every day. My second reaction, I guess, was that that Michael Fox might be a very good person to do the role, because it was going to be really important when we put this on the screen, getting people to identify with this character right off the bat, who's doing some unsympathetic things. In the book, you're inside his head. You have no choice. You have to identify with him. But in the movie, the movie camera is of necessity outside of everybody's head, and you have to have somebody who can sort of jump right through the lens and grab the heart of the audience, and that's something that Michael J. Fox, I think, has demonstrated many times that he can do. He's a very sympathetic person, and it seemed important to me for the message of this movie, insofar as there's a message, that you know, some people might have envisioned a kind of unshaven Mickey Rourke in this role, but this guy is a pretty, I mean, he's not so far from being the boy next door. And the point is, this could be the guy who grew up next to you, or mom, this could be your son. He's not some kind of lunatic. He's extremely well-educated. He's a middle-class boy. He's maybe a little smarter than you know, the average guy who flunked his SATs, but he's not a derelict. He's not a prodigy of any kind, and I think it was important to have someone as sympathetic and someone who looked so much like the boy next door as Michael J. Fox in order to get this point across.
You worked as a fact checker at The New Yorker for about 7 months, and that experience is alluded to in Bright Lights, Big City. Did you ever do anything that really hurt the reputation of The New Yorker, like your character in the novel did at his magazine?
No, I don't think so. I think I got a few things wrong here and there, and the whole point of the fact-checking department is that any little slip-up is the end of the world. That's the attitude you have to have if you're going to be a fact-checker. You know that a proper noun misspelled is reason to hang your head in shame and commit harakiri. You know, and I just didn't quite have that attitude. I was always more interested in an interesting lie than in a boring fact.
Have you nevertheless used any of your fact-checking skills in your work as a novelist?
I did learn how to research material pretty quickly and efficiently. But in general, I think they're kind of antithetical occupations, and I am a storyteller and not necessarily a kind of lover of raw facts. It's really a completely different mentality, and clearly I discovered where my sympathies lay. As I say, you know, tell me a good yarn any day, and I don't care if the facts are right or not.
Do you feel that there have been any false assumptions about who Jay McInerney is based on who the characters are that you've created?
Well, I think that people just assume that I'm the main character in Bright Lights, Big City, and I get a little tired of people calling me at 3 in the afternoon and saying, "Oh, did I wake you up?" you know, I mean, this sort of formulaic identification of a novelist with his protagonists, I think, is pretty naive. And clearly the guy who is in Bright Lights, Big City would not have been able to sit down and write the book. He would have, at the very least, had to become somebody else in order to do it. I suppose that's one reason that in my new book I've decided to kind of hide behind a female character. I really exhausted my interest in for the moment, in writing about young male protagonists, people who do take off from aspects of my own character, and I wanted to put myself into the shoes of a woman.
So there'll be no confusion?
Well, I hope not.
Okay.
I think people would have to really stretch to imagine me as a 20-year-old aspiring actress, but then I don't know.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
My guest has been Jay McInerney, the author of Bright Lights, Big City, Ransom, and a new novel called Story of My Life, which just been published by Atlantic Monthly Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with crime novelist Andrew Vox. He finds models for the characters in his books during his day job as an attorney specializing in child abuse cases. I hope you can join us.
Bright light, big city, gone to my baby's head. Bright light, big city, gone to my baby's head. I tried to tell the woman.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Beard had to recreate scenes from the Bible for two movies, The Last Temptation of Christ and the Monty Python biblical spoof, The Life of Brian. Beard was the production designer on both films. Coming up, he tells us how to keep actors comfortable on the cross. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Burt Wilson and his band. Kevin says Wilson's just part of the overlooked West Coast jazz scene. And television critic David Bianculli reviews USA Today, the television show. It's a daily syndicated news program from the same people who published the USA Today newspaper. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The U.S. may cut off financial aid to Burma following a coup yesterday, which has resulted in as many as 400 deaths, reportedly. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today the U.S. deplores the violence, and he urged Burmese military authorities to begin immediate talks with opposition leaders. Violence erupted in some Burmese cities after the army seized power yesterday, saying it wanted to halt deteriorating conditions all over the country. Christopher Gunness has the latest from Rangoon.
Suburbs of Rangoon, ferocious pitch battles continued into the evening between groups of armed demonstrators and troops. Four police stations in the city's western sector were overrun by anti-government groups earlier in the day, and large quantities of guns, including automatic firearms, were seized. Many have armed themselves with lethal homemade weapons, such as bows and arrows fixed with exploding heads. Fierce fighting is reported outside a bank on Insane Road in the northwest of the capital. Though there are few details of casualties, reports speak of over 100 deaths, and some observers put the figure far higher. Rangoon Radio has announced that several soldiers have been killed. According to eyewitnesses in the capital, 8 army personnel died after being attacked in the Bengali district of Rangoon.
The BBC's Christopher Gunness. The United States is watching developments in Haiti in the wake of yesterday's military coup there. General Prosper Avril, a former aide to the Duvalier dictatorship, seized control, replacing the military regime of General Henri Nomfi. The coup comes 3 months after Nomfi ousted Haiti's elected president. The White House views as a problem the reported appointment of Army Colonel Jean-Claude Paul as Armed Forces Chief of Staff. Paul has been indicted on drug trafficking charges in the U.S. The TASS news agency today reported a weekend gun battle between Armenians and Azerbaijanis. The clash occurred in the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh and reportedly injured 17 people. The shootout marked an escalation of tensions between the two ethnic groups, who have been at odds over control of the area for 7 months. Yesterday's violence also set off a series of general strikes. The presidential candidates focused on the economy today. Michael Dukakis criticized the Reagan administration for engineering an economic recovery that has excluded the poor and middle class. George Bush defended his administration's record on the economy. He addressed a business group near Philadelphia. Karen Santos of member station WHYY has details.
The Republican presidential nominee used graphs and charts in his address as he condemned federal regulations and taxes on small businesses. Bush was warmly received, especially as he got off this quip to the sympathetic crowd.
The meek shall inherit the earth, but they'll never increase market share.
Bush reiterated his call for a cut in the capital gains tax, which he says would boost federal revenues as it spurs economic growth and creates jobs. Cutting the taxes paid on profits made on stock and real estate sales and certificates of deposit is a move the Democratic nominee, Michael Dukakis, has called preposterous. But Bush says Dukakis is trying to divide Americans by emphasizing differences between the rich and the poor. For National Public Radio, I'm Karen Santos in Philadelphia.
By a vote of 83-9, the Senate today approved a landmark free trade agreement between the United States and Canada. The pact would eliminate all tariffs and reduce other trade barriers between the two countries over the next 10 years. The House approved the agreement last month. The measure now goes to the White House, where President Reagan is virtually certain to sign it. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed lower in slow trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 17 points to close at 2081.08. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has been thinking lately about the lively jazz scene on the West Coast. He has a review of The Next Rebirth, a new album by Pacific Northwest saxophonist and bass clarinetist Burt Wilson and his group Rebirth. At one time, Wilson played with John Coltrane, and for the past 10 years, he's been leading his own group.
For 30 years, West Coast jazz musicians have been dogged with an image problem. Call it the wimp factor. Since the 1950s, a few smug Easterners have dismissed jazz from the Pacific seaboard as limp and enervated stuff. It's a bum rap. This stereotype was only marginally accurate 30 years ago and is even less so now. Responding to these attacks, a brace of West Coast saxophonists have come out swinging hard. The late Art Pepper led the charge, now taken up by Frank Morgan from Los Angeles, and by Bud Shank and Burt Wilson in Washington State. Wilson is the least known of the bunch, but his album shows what he has going for him, like the nervous angularity of L.A.'s Eric Dolphy and a serrated vibrato reminiscent of California's Arthur Blythe. But Wilson's keening falsetto and relentless swing are his own. Listen to Burt Wilson on his tune, Upside. Wilson has said that being confined to a wheelchair as a result of polio has given him lots of time to practice. His alto and tenor solos let him soar, and his go-for-broke attitude makes for invigorating tension. He seems constantly in danger of going over the edge. The distinctive sound of his sextet Rebirth comes from using Nancy Curtis's flute rather than a trumpet to complement his saxes. Here's a sample of Wilson's tango, Allison by Moonlight. Nancy Curtis's flute tone is almost classically pure, touched with the reserve that is at the heart of stereotypes about cool West Coast jazz. But Curtis's flute may skate over odd intervals, blurring the harmonies. Her controlled voice balances the leader's excesses too, as on Burt Wilson's Where Love Is. Thank you.
The other members of the Sextet Rebirth are the hard-driving pianist Alan Youngblood, bassist Chuck Metcalf, percussionist Michael Olson, and drummer Bob Meyer, who gets a sharply defined, almost melodic sound from his drum kit. Like Wilson, these players seem to push against the limits of the material even as they're pulling together. That's what makes Burt Wilson's music riveting. It has an edgy intensity that comes from stretching familiar forms almost to their breaking point.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Burt Wilson's new album, The Next Rebirth, on the Nine Winds label. This is Fresh Air. John Beard had the credentials Martin Scorsese was looking for when Scorsese was hiring a production designer for The Last Temptation of Christ. Beard had already served as art director on another biblical film. Only that film was the Monty Python biblical spoof, The Life of Brian. Beard was also the art director on the film Brazil, created by ex-Python Terry Gilliam. We invited John Beard to the NPR Bureau in London to discuss his latest recreation of biblical times, working with Scorsese and actor Willem Dafoe, who stars as Christ. But when I asked Beard what he thought of the finished film, his answer wasn't what I expected.
The first thing I should tell you is I haven't yet seen the film. It actually opens in London tonight, so I'm going to see it in about a couple of hours' time.
You know, it surprises me in a way that you haven't seen The Last Temptation of Christ yet, because I thought that a production designer would have to always see how the rushes looked to see if the designs were working or not, if they looked convincing on film.
Yeah, certainly in the studio, when we're working in the studio, that every morning or every evening you go in and look at the previous day's work and check everything, and if it didn't work, you do it again. But I think when you're in Morocco, you haven't even got the laboratories to develop the films. But such was the sort of the tight schedule that it had to be achieved under. We just had to continue. There's no alternative but to keep going and believe that everything that we were doing was working.
Describe the role of a production designer.
Well, it depends a lot where we are, but in this case, you know, a film that's going to be done totally on location, although we're building, it means choosing where to go, going to the country, finding the locations, building on location, finding props, dressing things, all kinds of things, just getting the whole job organised, really, and making sure, above all, that everything's ready on the day when the director and the actors turn up.
Did Scorsese ever sit down with you and say, here's what I'm going after, here's the kind of look I want?
Yeah, well, we sat down. When I got the call, I went to meet Marty for a week in New York, and we sat down and looked at reference he'd been looking at, for, as you know, for many, many years, really, and I think he knew that he wanted a very simple and hard and primitive look, which was what, above all, we were going for.
Now, why did you choose Morocco as the location for the shoot?
I think the decision to shoot in North Africa generally had been chosen before I arrived. And once he knew that Morocco was a place where it could be done, or rather North Africa was a place where it could be done, I went with him to both Tunisia and Morocco, which Tunisia is where we actually did Life of Brian, but we took it. We spent a week there and looked at locations we used, but they're all now resort hotels and coach car parks, so everything was lost there. So we went on to Morocco and liked it much better, and so tried to find everything that we needed to fulfill the script there, which it did.
I'm interested in the crucifixion scene. The characters in the crucifixion scene are crucified in a way I would describe as side saddle. The legs are bent at the knee and twisted to one side. And I mean, my experience with crucifixions is in paintings and movies, but I don't think I've seen it done like that before.
Well, you know, it is known that tens of thousands of people were crucified, but they've only ever found one body that they know was crucified, because the nails were still in the feet attached to a piece of wood. And that had the very position that we use. We're in the sort of crouched position with the legs bent and turned to the side.
When you first designed the crosses, did you test it out on stuntmen or on the actual actors?
No, I think once we'd sort of worked out a design and proportion and everything, I think that Willem was as keen to try everything as much as he could, really. And such was a sort of shortage of crew. I think that, you know, everyone was really had to do their own job, more or less.
Did you feel like a torturer having to invent this for the movie?
No, because I think all the time that we're doing it, we're trying to make it work. Be most comfortable and know that people have got to be on it for days on end, and that if we can't make it work for the film, then we can't use it, and which it goes for anything that we want. We have to do, really, whatever it looks like. If it doesn't work for the film, we can't use it, and that's it.
So it's got to look like torture but feel comfortable enough for the actors.
Yeah, yes. Although the difference was on The Last Temptation that everything, all the crosses were for real, you know, that the pieces of wood that Willem carried were really, really heavy, solid timbers, whereas on Life of Ryan, they were made of balsa wood, fiberglass, anything. Marty and Willem himself really, really wanted the weight of the cross, the timber upon him, and that's what he got.
I'm wondering what it's like to be on location, dressed in your jeans and T-shirt or whatever the clothes are that you're working in, and you look around you, and here's all these men in loincloths or naked getting crucified on crosses. It must be a very odd and slightly disorienting experience.
Yes, I mean, it's probably hard to look at it in those terms when you've been doing things for 10 years or more, and, I mean, at the moment, I'm on a Viking epic.
Your film Brazil was set in the future. And The Last Temptation of Christ and The Life of Brian are set in the past. Do you mostly do films like that, or do you do many films that are set in the present?
I think I prefer working in sort of post-war, whether it's the future or the recent past, or I like medieval and ancient history. I'm not very keen on sort of 18th, 19th century period things. I like something where there's more freedom, I suppose, to express it.
Oh, I have another question about Last Temptation of Christ. Many of the women in The Last Temptation of Christ have tattoos on their faces and on their bodies, and it's something I haven't seen in any religious films before. I was wondering if there was a historical precedent for that.
Well, I think a lot of those things, really, I mean, whether it was the crown of thorns, which actually, when we looked around Morocco and looked at the bushes that were available, rather than it wasn't manufactured as a kind of prop, it was made from, you know, the bushes that actually existed. And just the same with the women, the tattoos, it was things we still see on the local people there, you know, that probably have remained unchanged for hundreds of years.
When you were filming The Last Temptation of Christ, were there scenes that would come to your mind from The Life of Brian that would suddenly make you laugh?
No. No, because actually The Life of Brian was quite serious in the making. And I suppose one of the things as well that does happen a lot is that because my job is basically to get everything ready, as soon as the actors and the camera arrive, and everything seems fine and work starts, then I immediately disappear to the next set or location to get that ready. So I'm not there for, you know, hours, days on end, watching all the filming take place.
When you go see The Last Temptation of Christ, which you're about to do, and you're going to see it for the first time, what are you going to be looking for? Is there any particular scene that you are going to be watching for?
Well, some of the things, yeah. One of the things is the Garden of Gethsemane, because I mean, one of the problems we had with the film was that we're actually in Morocco at a very bad time of year. We're actually ended up in the sort of start of the winter, the wrong side of the Atlas Mountains in the rainy season. And every day when we wanted, you know, hot, dry desert scenes, but there was rain. And one day, in fact, the unit was more or less washed away by a flood. And so there was one beautiful location we had for the Garden of Gethsemane, which Marty had seen and we planned to use for a long, long while. And then there was just so much rain towards the end of the film that we knew that it was too much of a chance to go there. And so because there's no studios in Morocco, we were having to find interior places where we could build sets and it was safe from the weather. In this particular case, I found this sort of cavernous vault beneath a ruined palace, and we sort of chopped down an olive grove and truckloads of rock and arranged the Garden of Gethsemane. People tell me that no one knows that it's actually inside and it's not outside an olive grove, but that's one of the things I'll be looking at.
John Beard was the production designer on The Last Temptation of Christ. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
What story are you following today?
Well, we're following reports of new violence down in Nagorno-Karabakh that's between the Azeris of Azerbaijan and the ethnic Armenians, who were the majority of that enclave within the Azerbaijan, and the Armenians want that region attached to the Soviet Armenian Republic. Also, a word of an unusual event in an East European country, the resignation of the government, not the party, but the government in Poland submitted its resignation. The prime minister gave a rather bitter speech to parliament. The Israelis launched a satellite today. That's an unprecedented event in the Middle East. And some bad news for those who believe in the Shroud of Turin.
Oh, what? We'll find out. Okay, those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of a new TV news show spun off from a daily newspaper. It won't turn your fingers black, you won't leave it on the bus, but David says you won't learn much either.
TV and movie executives love to come up with dumb words and phrases to describe even dumber concepts. High concept, for example, is the term used for any idea that can be described and sold in 10 words or less. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Human detective takes cartoon rabbit as a client. That's high concept. Then there are two personal favorites, zipping and zapping. Stay with me here, because this is all true. Zapping is the word used to describe what happens when bored TV viewers start to switch randomly among several channels, especially but not exclusively when a commercial comes on. And when people with VCRs are playing back a program they recorded earlier and they fast-forward through the commercials, that's called zipping. From the point of view of the people who make or sponsor TV shows, zipping is bad, but zapping is worse. Last week, though, a new series premiered that incorporates all these bizarre ideas at once. It's the new nightly syndicated program called USA Today, the television show. It's high concept, TV version of the USA Today newspaper, and each story zooms by so quickly, then jumps to something so unrelated, that it's the first TV show in history that comes pre-zipped and pre-zapped. Here, for example, is a report from sports anchor Bill McAtee, presented on the eve of the opening ceremonies of the Summer Olympics.
And our U.S. Olympic team is in Seoul now. Opening ceremonies are tomorrow night. And once again, our boxing team is expected to be very strong. Our super heavyweight is among the favorites for the gold. This guy's name is Riddick Bowe, and he does a great impression of Muhammad Ali.
Bowe, I know you're one of the greatest fighters of all time. You're gonna float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. I just hope that you don't get greater than me.
Not bad. Let's see if he can do that impression of Ali when he gets in the ring in Seoul.
That's right.
That's it for us tonight.
Including the introduction, that report was 20 seconds long, and that was it. The TV version of USA Today zipped through that story so fast that we never even got to hear the guy's real voice. Not to mention that of the 8 million stories in the Olympic Village, that was probably the stupidest. It's the form, not the content, that counts on this show. First you zip, then you zap. But as glitzy and stupid as this show is, its real problem is that it doesn't even deliver on its concept. Let's be generous here and say that the newspaper USA Today has its strengths. Sports fans can drown in statistics, people interested in the weather can spend all the time they want analyzing its full-color maps and charts, and people interested in mass entertainment can gobble up every rumor, news release, or program cancellation. With the newspaper, though, you can ignore what you don't like and dive into what you do. USA Today, the television show, is so bad that it's almost camp, which means that a lot of curious or warped people will want to tune in once just to experience its awfulness for themselves. Do me a favor. Treat it like an eclipse and don't look at it without taking proper precautions. Tape it first and fast forward through all the really idiotic parts. That'll get TV's USA Today experience over with in no time. And by using your VCR that way, you can go out there and win one for the zipper.
David Bianculio is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I speak with rock impresario Malcolm McLaren, the man who organized and promoted the punk band The Sex Pistols. He later referred to his success as the great rock and roll swindle. His work is the subject of an exhibit at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the career of Captain Beefheart, one of rock's most eccentric personalities. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Great Divide, Studs Terkel's new collection of first-person profiles. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.